Our colloquium speaker today, Professor John Dutcher, is from the University of Guelph, our neighboring sister institution. He's from the Department of Physics. He got his undergraduate in Dalhousie. Then he moved to UBC to do his master's, and then to Simon Fraser to do his PhD. Creating tremendous amount of diversity in his graduate education, which is a good lesson for our undergraduates, those who may be in the audience. It is after that he went to Optical Sciences Center in Tucson, Arizona, did his postdoc, and came to University of Guelph in 1990. He just recently has been appointed in University of Guelph, the senior tier CRC chair, and rightly so. He has many fabulous research accomplishments to his credit. He works in surfaces and interfaces. People who take course in thermodynamics, of course, know that thermodynamic limit wipes out all the surfaces. But the real physics is in systems with surfaces and interfaces. He is, in many ways, experimentalist par excellence in polymer area. He has been working in thin polymer films, freestanding, or with support. Polymer layers with cap, without cap. He is probably most well known for his contribution that the glass transition temperature in thin polymer films depends on the thickness in a very significant way. Today, however, he is going to talk more about instabilities and dynamics. His title of his talk is Complex Flow of Nano-Confined Polymers. John, please join me back.
Thank you very much, Rashmi, and thank you for the invitation to come here and tell you a little bit about what we're doing in my research group at the University of Guelph. As Rashmi mentioned, I'm not going to be talking about glass transition results today. Instead, I'm going to be talking about some of the pattern formation work that we've done with a couple of different systems. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about the nature of instabilities in freely standing liquid films. And then I'm going to focus on two different cases, both which involve so-called freely standing polymer films. In the first case, it's a single freely standing polymer film, and we're going to heat them up. And when you heat them up, what happens is that holes will form and grow in these films, which can be a nuisance if you're trying to study the properties of the films, but one can also look at it as if the glass is half full and to try and use the growth of these holes to learn something about the properties, the flow properties of these polymer molecules confined to film thicknesses that are typically tens of nanometers. It turns out that hole growth in freely standing polystyrene films is an ideal geometry for observing a nonlinear viscoelastic phenomenon called shear thinning, and it just may provide us with a unique window on the convective constraint release relaxation mechanism of something called the tube theory of entangled polymers. The second example involves hole growth in multi-layer films, in particular tri-layer films, where the outer layers are polystyrene, common coffee cup polymer, and in the middle we have a central layer of a much softer polymer, polyisoprene, which is natural rubber. And what we find in that case is hole formation at a buried interface. Holes form and grow within the central polyisoprene layer. And these two cases of hole growth give qualitatively different behavior. So before I begin, let me just give you an overview of the kinds of projects that we study in my group. We work on polymers, biopolymers, and even bacterial cells at surfaces. In the polymer area, we look at how these confined polymers can move when they're confined dramatically in this one direction. They can move on different length scales, so we can look at segmental mobility through a measurement of the glass transition, or whole chain motion through measurements of hole growth. We can also look at instabilities in pattern formation in these films. And we have a recent project that we're gearing up to do now to look at enzymatic degradation of biodegradable polymer films. In addition, we're interested in studying the interaction between biopolymers like polypeptides and proteins with a variety of different surfaces, including tethered lipid membranes and polymer brush surfaces. And we're ambitious enough, or foolish enough as physicists, to think that we can contribute to the study of bacterial cells at surfaces, which of course is a huge problem in a variety of different technologies, medical and industrial. And in addition to trying to study how these bacteria adhere to surfaces and what the physical characteristics of bacterial biofilms are, we're also interested in looking at the bacteria and their biofilms as a source of unique materials, the sacculus that forms the bag for the bacterium is a very unique biomaterial. The slime that the bacteria encase themselves in, polysaccharide matrix, is a unique material. The fact that they can respire metals and make novel phases of nanominerals and bleeb off small membrane vesicles that can be used for drug delivery purposes are all issues with that we're currently interested in. To study all of these things, which include the structure, dynamics, interaction forces, molecular conformations, absorption kinetics, we use a variety of different techniques that are listed here. Most of those are in my lab, but I also have very good collaborations with other scientists in chemistry and microbiology at the University of Guelph. And we've benefited, I guess, a lot from recent awards through CFI. So that's really, really helped us a lot. And I would claim that our facilities for studying molecules at surfaces are pretty much second to none in the world. Okay, that's a pretty bold statement, but I think it's almost true. Let me say a few words about thin liquid films. They're everywhere in our everyday life, from adhesives such as superglue to lubricants on the cornea of your eye or the piston of an engine, spray coatings for paints and herbicides, or coatings on fibers to produce exotic fabrics such as Gore-Tex, printing on low-energy surfaces such as polymers, soap bubbles and films that you see when you're doing the dishes or taking a shower, to foams such as shaving cream or your cappuccino in the morning. And for all of these cases, the stability of the liquid film is either desirable or essential for how they work. I've also listed a couple of examples down here of water films for which the stability of the film is undesirable. For example, the detergent in your dishwasher uses a special additive that breaks up the water film to avoid spotting on the dishes. And car tires are designed explicitly to break up that thin water layer between the tire and the road to avoid hydroplaning. So if I consider an instability in a water film or a soap film, something with a very low value of the viscosity, I can somehow form a hole in this film. This might spontaneously nucleate at a defect in the film, or one can poke it in order to generate a hole. In either case, what one finds when one looks at the growth of the holes in these films is that the fluid tends to collect in a rim at the edge of the hole, leaving the rest of the film undisturbed. So what I have indicated here is just two cross sections of the film with time increasing as I move down, showing the hole growing. As the hole grows, the material accumulates at the edge of the hole. Experimentally, if you measure the radius of this film as a function of time, you find that it grows linearly with time. And this can be understood theoretically by considering either a force balance on a fluid element near the edge of the hole, or by a balance of the time rate of change of the different relevant energy contributions. In this case, the time rate of change of the kinetic energy is balanced by the time rate of change of the surface energy as specified by the surface tension. And in this case, one finds that the velocity of the whole is a constant value. Now, I'm not going to be talking about non-viscous films in this talk. I'm going to be talking about polymer films. And I realize that not everybody in this room is a polymer physicist. So let me just tell you, in a few words, what I need you to know for the purposes of this talk. So polymer molecules are much more complicated than hydrogen atoms. They are what you would call extended complex molecules, where we have a repeat unit or monomer, which is joined end to end to form a long chain polymer molecule in the simplest possible linear molecule geometry. There are different length scales. So what I've done here is I've sketched one chain at one particular time. Okay, so what you find is that in a collection of similar molecules, these chains tend to form in the so-called random coil configuration. So imagine that you're making spaghetti and you put in one noodle that's red, and you cook up your spaghetti and you dump out all the water, and then you look at the shape of that red noodle, okay? And then you do it again, and then you do it again, and you do this a large number of times, and what you find is that on average, that noodle has a certain end-to-end distance, and one can characterize this statistical quantity by the root mean square end-to-end distance, which is sort of indicated schematically here, and overall size of the polymer molecule, which for relatively long chains is tens of nanometers. Okay, and what we're interested, okay, I guess I should say that the different length scales range from the sizes of the different segments to the overall chain size. And this end-to-end distance scales is the square root of the length of the chain or its molecular weight. Corresponding to that range of length scales, there is a range of time scales ranging from relaxation of individual segments to movement of the entire molecule. What we're interested in doing is taking such polymer molecules and putting them into a polymer film. Okay? And by doing this, we can choose the polymer film thickness to be greater than, comparable to, or even less than the overall size of the molecule. And so what we can explore is the effect of confinement in one dimension of these molecules in thin films. And one might expect, obviously, there will be a distortion of the conformation of the molecule because it's being compressed in one direction, and perhaps even a corresponding change in its dynamics. Of course, we are not in our experiment taking a film and compressing it, but rather we are preparing different films of different thicknesses, each one of which might continually get smaller. So what happens when we heat up these polymer films? Well, polymers, especially if the polymer molecules are long, the molecules are very much entangled with one another. And this means that they move overall, the entire molecules move on very long timescales compared with the timescale for hole growth in a non-viscous soap film. In addition, hole growth in a polymer, freely standing polymer film is qualitatively different because as the hole forms and grows, as I've indicated in these schematic pictures, there's no rim at the edge of the hole. Instead, the film thickens uniformly as time proceeds. So qualitatively different picture. And if you measure the hole radius as a function of time, what you find is that the hole radius grows exponentially with time. What I've shown here is a plot from data obtained by Françoise Brochard-Wyart's group in Paris, in which they took relatively thick films of a polymer called PDMS, polydimethyl siloxane, and they poked holes in it and measured the growth of the holes in this polymer film. And this is their data, so the log of the radius versus linear time is a straight line corresponding to exponential growth of the hole radius. And one can understand this, also theoretically, by looking at a balance between the time rate of change of the surface energy as specified by the surface tension, and the viscous energy as specified by the viscosity of the film. In this case, one finds that the time rate of change of the radius is proportional to the radius, corresponding to exponential growth with a certain characteristic time constant tau. So let me tell you a little bit how we make these freely standing polymer films. First of all, we start with well-characterized, synthesized artificial molecules that we buy from a reliable source. Actually, it's called Polymer Source in Quebec. And they're relatively high molecular weight polymers that are all very much the same length. And so we can use the length of the molecule as a valid parameter, and we can look at different lengths of the polymers. We dissolve these in a good solvent, which is typically toluene. And then we drop one drop of this polymer solution, typically about 1% polymer by mass, onto a spinning substrate, which is smooth, something like a glass slide or a silicon substrate or a piece of mica. Mica turns out to be good for the purposes of creating a freely standing film, because after we heat it up under vacuum to remove residual solvent, and then we stick the film on the mica substrate through a water surface, the film prefers the water surface more than it does the mica substrate, and so it floats off onto the water surface, and we can come from underneath with essentially a washer and capture that polymer film across the hole in the washer, which is typically about 4 millimeters in diameter. So we're left with a polymer film supported on the outside edge with air in the middle on either side, so-called freely standing film. So there are a couple of things about hole growth in polymer films that I should mention to you. I mentioned before that when you look at these films, there's no accumulation of material at the edge of the hole. Instead, the film thickens uniformly. If you look at the flow profile within the plane of the film, what you find is that it's uniform across the thickness of the film, okay? So-called plug flow, which is a particularly simple flow profile, which is nicely amenable to computer simulation. Once the hole forms, actually the role of surface tension in this is interesting, because before the hole forms, surface tension tends to prevent the formation of a hole. But once a hole forms, maybe at a piece of dust that was in the film, then surface tension is actually the driving force to make the hole larger. It's like an elastic band that's sort of pulling at the edge of the hole, making it larger and larger with time. And one can think of the stress acting at the edge of the hole as being 2 times the surface tension, epsilon, divided by the thickness of the film. And so as you make the film thinner and thinner, the size of the stress acting at the edge of the hole, tending to make the hole bigger, is larger and larger. Another important point is that as the hole grows in the film, the polymer chains near the edge of the hole tend to align. And the easiest way to see this is to imagine a fluid element at the edge of the hole, a square element of fluid, which is oriented such that the diagonal lies along the radial direction. Okay? And what I've shown here are essentially 2 snapshots in time. And as the hole grows, the square element becomes squashed along the radial direction and extended along the tangential direction. And this corresponds to a shear strain of this fluid element, and with a corresponding tendency for the molecules to align parallel to the tangent direction on the hole. In addition, I show here just a series of optical micrographs for a hole growing in a freely standing film. This is what it looks like under the microscope. So our first measurements of hole growth in freely standing films involved a single value of the length of the chain, or the molecular weight, a certain range of film thicknesses ranging from about 100 nanometers up to 400 nanometers, and heating the sample to a relatively high temperature, about 18 degrees above the bulk value of the glass transition temperature. And these are the results that we got here. This is a plot, essentially, of the logarithm of the radius versus linear time. And you can see that in each case, corresponding to different film thicknesses, you see a straight line corresponding to exponential growth, and one over the slope of this line is the characteristic growth time. One can relate the characteristic growth time to the film viscosity at the edge of the hole. One knows from a simple geometrical argument that the so-called shear strain rate, gamma dot, so this is the time rate of change of the shear stress, is 2 divided by the characteristic growth time, and that allows one to make a plot of viscosity versus shear strain rate. And what you find is, these are both on logarithmic scales, is you find a power law decrease in the viscosity with increasing shear strain rate. And this is consistent with the bulk phenomenon of shear thinning. So let me just explain a little bit about what shear thinning is. The best way to do this is to draw a schematic plot of the log of the viscosity versus the log of the shear strain rate. And what one finds is that for a large enough value of gamma dot, you get this power law decrease in the viscosity with increasing shear strain rate. And this occurs above some critical threshold value of gamma dot, such that if I'm below that threshold, I have a plateau here that corresponds to what you would call the zero shear strain rate value of the viscosity, eta zero. A couple of things that are important is that shear thinning is only observed if the polymer molecules are entangled with one another, only if the chains are sufficiently long. And another thing that is indicated by this plot right here, once again a plot of log viscosity versus log of gamma dot, is that in the nonlinear regime, the viscosity value that you measure is independent of the molecular weight. So what we did was to do a more comprehensive study of hole growth in freely standing polystyrene films at different temperatures, different molecular weights, and different film thicknesses. And what we did was to measure the characteristic growth times tau, use that to obtain a viscosity at the edge of the hole, eta. That gives us an eta and a gamma dot. And in order to plot all of this data obtained under different conditions on a single plot, we made use of so-called reduced shear strain rate beta parameter that was first suggested by Gressley. And what this allows us to do by using this beta parameter on the horizontal axis is basically plot all of the data on the same plot. Okay? So what we have here is a plot of the viscosity divided by its zero strain rate value as calculated from bulk measurements on polymer samples versus this reduced shear strain rate beta. The original data set that I showed to you on the previous slide is corresponds to the open squares that you can see here. In addition, there was another study that came out at close to the same time that looked at hole growth in much thicker films at much higher temperatures, and that corresponds to the open circles right here. And the results from this present study performed using optical microscopy correspond to the colored data points that you see here. And what you find is that, first of all, the data collectively corresponds to 7 orders of magnitude reduction in the viscosity for a range in these beta parameters of about 11 orders of magnitude. So the size of the changes in these parameters is huge. We get a slope for the nonlinear regime here, which agrees very well with the bulk value that's measured in bulk samples, so we know that that's what we're measuring. We get a value of 1 up here without doing anything special. It's telling us that we actually are going from the nonlinear regime to the linear regime for this data set collected by another group at higher temperatures and larger film thicknesses. And in addition, we did another experiment that I'll mention in a few minutes called a differential pressure experiment that allows us to go to much lower temperatures and extend the range of the data here even further. So the optical microscopy data that I show you here is in dark circles, and the data obtained with this other differential pressure experiment is shown with open blue triangles. And now we have a factor of 10 to the 8th reduction in the viscosity for a range in beta values of about 12 orders of magnitude. So it's a fairly impressive plot, I think. And I think it provides compelling evidence that we're seeing shear thinning corresponding to viscous flow of aligned molecules at the edge of the hole. Wait a second. How can we have flow at temperatures that are comparable to the bulk glass transition temperature? Okay, most people have some vague idea of what a glass transition temperature is. Basically, it is a history-dependent temperature that separates a viscous liquid at high temperature from a glassy solid at low temperature. Okay, so as you cool a sample from a high temperature, a glass-forming sample, at some point the motion freezes out and it forms instead a glassy solid. And one can characterize that transition by a temperature. For polystyrene, it's about 100 degrees C. We're seeing hole growth for temperatures that are comparable to that temperature. So I would expect, anyway, that at temperatures next or close to TG, that I would have to include not only viscous flow, but also an elastic response, right? Because you're at that transition between a viscous fluid and an elastic solid. But what we find instead is that the late stage hole growth is well described by viscous flow on its own. So that, to me, is a big surprise. However, there is some precedent for this in the literature. If one does the following experiment, you take a thin polymer film and you tug on it in the plane. Okay, so you put it under tension. It fails in a very specific way. Basically, defects within the film will form lines that will then extend out in a region that looks like this next to that defect line. And this is something that's called a craze in a polymer. And if you do this at low temperature, what you find is that you're actually breaking chains as you're pulling on the film. Right? And you get actually fibrils forming within this transition region here and voids. So fibrils and voids, it looks kind of messy. But if you do this process at an elevated temperature, instead of breaking the chains, you can actually disentangle the chains. And so Berger and Kramer, Ed Kramer did this study, very careful study, back in the 80s, and they found that for molecular weights that are comparable to what we're using, and for temperatures that are even lower than what we're using with comparable strain rates, they see chain disentanglement happening at very high temperatures. So how does this chain disentanglement happen? Why does it happen? Well, perhaps a clue for that can be seen by looking at the initial stages of the hole growth as observed using an optical microscope. This is work that was done by Connie Roth in my group, and she did a very careful study of this and found a very surprising result. She found that if she carefully measured the radius as a function of time, that instead of the hole growth being exponential with time, in the initial stages, it was very much linear with time. And that was a big surprising result, because if you remember back to the beginning of the talk, I said that it was only for non-viscous soap films that you would expect constant velocity. And so we didn't know what to make of this. But all of the data that she collected for different temperatures, different molecular weights, different film thicknesses were showing a systematic dependence of this initial stage of hole growth corresponding to linear hole growth. This is the same data set obtained on a film that's about 80 nanometers thick at a temperature of 103 degrees, a molecular weight of about 2 million. Same data set plotted in two different ways, radius versus time and logarithm of radius versus time. So you see in the initial stages, it's linear to a very good approximation. And in what we would call the late stage, it's exponential. And from this late stage you can extract this characteristic growth time tau, which is what I used on the previous slide to plot the shear thinning result. But what I want to do now is I want to focus on this rather odd behavior that we see at the beginning of each experiment. So what Connie did was to do a systematic study of this. So for example, she picked a particular value of the molecular weight and a particular film thickness, and she measured those different films at different temperatures. And this is what she got. Okay, so this is a plot of the natural logarithm of the whole radius versus time, where I've normalized the whole radius values to the whole radius measured at the characteristic growth time, and I've normalized the time values by this characteristic growth time. By doing so, what I do is I collapse all of the data in the late stage, and I highlight the differences in the initial stage. So you can see that the curves down here separate. I can highlight the initial stage even more by subtracting off that diagonal line, and this is what I get in this case. And now I see a very nice split between all those different curves at the initial stages. And what you find is that each of these curves is well described by a single exponential behavior, as I've indicated here for the data obtained at 103 degrees. So that's fit very well by a single exponential decay time that I can call, I don't know, tau 1. It's a different tau, right? Now, one thing that you have to keep in mind about this experiment is that when Connie's doing this experiment, she's looking through an optical microscope, hoping to find a hole that grows. Oh, is this a hole? No, it's not a hole. Going over here. Eventually, you find a hole that is growing in time, and then you can continue to measure its radius. But the start time for that hole is different from experiment to experiment. And so really what you want to do is you want to do something with these time values to try and take into account the fact that you're starting the experiment at a different stage of hole growth for each of the different films. So what we decided to do was basically to extrapolate the data back to a time, T0, corresponding to zero hole radius. So if I go back here, what we're doing basically is measuring the blue data here. But in order to get the time origin correct, we do this very modest extrapolation of the data back to zero radius. And we take this value T0 and subtract it from all of our curves. And what you find in that case is that all of these curves overlap with one another. Okay, so what we found is some kind of universal behavior with a characteristic decay time of this initial transient that scales with the characteristic growth time tau. So, you can do this, you can measure the initial stages of the data and the late stages of the data individually, but what you would really like to do is to have an expression that describes the data over the entire range of times that you've measured. And what we found was, empirically, is that the data was very well fit by this rather simple looking expression here. So this is essentially exponential hole growth, R equals R0 e to the t over tau, modified by this extra term that accounts for this initial transient behavior, the decay of which is characterized by the constant tau 1. Okay? And so this expression here describes all of the data very well. It's equivalent to a time-dependent viscosity and can also be described by a three-component spring and dashpot model where you apply a constant stress across the film and all of its behavior is described by three simple mechanical components, one spring and two dashpots that account for viscous losses. This is a big surprise because usually to simulate a polymer, you have to have a variety of different time constants, and so you have to have some big complicated maze of springs and dashpots. But for this simple system where we're seeing this exponential, single exponential decay of the initial transient behavior, it's described by this relatively simple model. How well is it described? Well, using these three fitting parameters, we can fit our data sets to extract R0, the value of the whole radius at the start of the measurement, the characteristic exponential growth time, tau, and tau 1, the decay time for the initial transient behavior. And in all cases, we get excellent fits. And if we plot the corresponding values of tau and tau 1 for all of the samples used in the study versus temperature, what we find is that there's considerable scatter in those values, but there's a definite decrease in both tau and tau 1 as you increase the temperature. Okay? In fact, if you look at the average value of the ratio of tau over tau 1, what you find is that it's about 2. Or in other words, this initial decay time, tau 1, is about half the value of tau. Okay? So how can we understand that? Well, we can understand this, I think, quite simply by going to what is called the tube model for polymer dynamics. Okay, the simplest, the zeroth order of this theory is the so-called theory of reptation. Okay, this is a mechanism proposed by Doy and Edwards and Degenne that describes the movement of a polymer chain within a tube defined by all of the molecules that surround it. And so basically, this molecule sloshes back and forth inside this tube, and if you wait for long enough, eventually it's moved either one way out of the tube or the other way out of the tube. And it's a way of characterizing motion of polymer molecules which are not under any undue influence. However, if you consider the effect of a shear stress on such a polymer, what you find is that in the so-called intermediate to high shear rate regime, which corresponds, when you work out the numbers, to our whole growth regime, is that you get the dominant relaxation mechanism is something called the convective constraint release mechanism. And basically, what's happening is that this thing is being sheared so quickly that, you know, the reptation time is irrelevant, right? What's important is the shear rate. And what you basically get is a chain disentanglement with a characteristic time scale that's 1 over the shear strain rate. What we find is that the tau 1 empirically is about half the value of tau, which is what you would expect from the previous slide for the convective constraint release mechanism. So I think we have evidence that what's happening here at the edge of the hole is that we start from entangled polymers, and in a very short period of time, as a hole forms and grows, the chains are disentangled very dramatically, ultimately reaching a state in which they're highly aligned with a viscosity that can be reduced by up to 8 orders of magnitude from what it was originally. So it's a very dramatic shearing of these molecules. Okay. I just wanted to mention very briefly a cute experiment that we used in order to measure hole growth at low temperatures. This is the so-called differential pressure experiment that I referred to before. It's a very simple experiment in which the heart of the experiment is a pressure cell divided into two compartments with a hole between the two compartments. And across that hole, you place a freely standing polymer film. And if the film is intact and at room temperature, it forms a perfect barrier between these two compartments. You then hook this up to a differential pressure sensor and basically an active feedback loop which controls the pressure in the lower compartment of the cell. So this is essentially just a stepper motor connected to a Fisher Scientific syringe. And you set it up so that the piston or the syringe does whatever it needs to do in order to maintain a small constant pressure difference across that film. At room temperature, it's a perfect barrier, so the syringe is just going to dither back and forth by a very small amount. But as you heat up this film, holes will form and grow in this film at elevated temperatures, and now you've got an imperfect barrier with gas flow from the bottom of the bottom chamber to the top chamber. And now, in order to maintain that pressure difference, the piston has to drift monotonically in one direction. And so if you plot the piston position versus time, you see a very characteristic signature of the growth, the formation and growth of holes in these films. And from the shape of this curve, you can extract the characteristic growth time. And one thing you can do is, with this experiment, is go to much lower temperatures, because if you go to a lower temperature, it takes much longer for holes to form and grow within this film. So if you're using an optical microscope, you have to have a lot of patience in order to do this experiment at low temperature. Okay? However, if you use this differential pressure experiment, you can basically set it up and, you know, go home and come back in the next morning and look at a run that took place over maybe 12 hours. And so it's much more amenable to collecting data at lower temperatures and allowing us to extend our temperature range. And it also allowed us to look at much thinner films. What I show here are the characteristic tau values versus temperature for films made with three different thicknesses, ranging from about 90 nanometers down to 50 nanometers. The reason why this range of film thicknesses is interesting is that at 90 nanometers, for this value of the molecular weight, the glass transition temperature you measure for this film is the bulk value of the glass transition temperature, about 100 degrees C. However, as you decrease the film thickness, this is something that Rashmi alluded to at the beginning of the talk, the glass transition temperature is decreased dramatically, such that for a 50 nanometer thick film, we're talking about a room temperature glass transition temperature, so a reduction of about 25% in the glass transition temperature. And so the segmental dynamics corresponding to the glass transition temperature are very different for these different collections of films. However, when you do the whole growth measurement, what you find is that there are some systematic shifts between the different data sets, but they're not that big. They're only a couple of degrees between a horizontal shift between each of these curves, okay, instead of the 50 or 70 degree shift in the glass transition temperature. In fact, this small shift decrease or shift to the left as I decrease the film thickness can be completely accounted for by the increase in the stress applied at the edge of the hole, because that went like 2 times the surface tension over the film thickness. I'm making the film thickness smaller, so I'm increasing the size of that stress. And if I take that into account, once again, all the data sort of overlaps on top of each other. So this is just that small shift between the curves is just explained once again by this bulk phenomenon of shear thinning. And we're left with this intriguing result that despite large differences in the glass transition temperature, the hole formation occurs only at temperatures comparable to or greater than the bulk value of the glass transition temperature. So this can be explained possibly in three different ways. Either there is a difference in the mobility parallel to the sample and perpendicular to the sample. In order for a hole to form, we need sufficient mobility perpendicular to the sample, and that may not occur. You could imagine the case where you have enough segmental mobility laterally, but not enough across the thickness of the film, so that you would need to go to much higher temperatures for a hole to form across the thickness, whereas you can actually have segmental mobility occurring at much lower temperatures. You could also explain this as a decoupling of the motion on different length scales. Maybe hole growth, which corresponds to motion of entire chains, is in a different regime now than segmental motion on a much smaller length scale. So I won't say anything more about that now. One thing I did want to do was to switch gears now and tell you a little bit about hole growth in another type of system. This is another case of a freely standing polymer film, but now it's made up of three different layers. Two layers on the outside are identical and are made of a relatively stiff material, and the central layer is essentially a fluid layer. Okay, and what can make up samples in which the capping layers are, let's say, glass, and the central layer is polystyrene? You heat this thing up high enough, well above the glass transition temperature of the central layer, and what happens is you get this characteristic pattern that forms spontaneously at elevated temperature. In this case, we're talking about a film which is polystyrene for the outer layers and natural rubber or polyisoprene in the central layer. Polyisoprene has a glass transition temperature of about minus 70 degrees C, Okay, so at room temperature, it's very much a fluid, and the polystyrene is very much a glassy solid. And so what happens when you heat it up is you see the formation of this banded structure. This is looking down on the film from the top. So you start off with a film, a tri-layer film of uniform thickness, and as you heat it up, you see the bands form, and basically what's happening is that you have two contributions to the free energy of the film. You have a van der Waals interaction, which is acting across the thickness of the film and would like nothing more than to make the film thickness zero. Okay? But in order to do that, it has to elastically bend the capping layers on either side of the film. And that's an energy cost. And because you get an energy gain from one and an energy cost from the other, that picks out a particular wavelength when you account for fluid flow from these pinched off regions. So what you end up with is a film whose cross-section looks something like this. Tubes of fluid that are separated by pinched off regions. And why do we get tubes instead of dots? Well, maybe the easiest way to think of that is if you have a capping layer like this, right? It's much easier to deform it like this than it is to deform it like this. Okay? In one dimension, it's easier to deform a rigid sheet. So the original work on this was done by Kari Dalnaki Barres, who's coming later this month to give you a colloquium on some recent things that he's been doing. Earlier this year, about 2 years ago, I guess, I was at a Gordon conference, and I spoke with a theorist from England. I spent about an hour and a half sort of enthusiastically telling him about all this stuff, and I never heard from him again until he published two papers earlier this year in which he referred to so-called Dutcher films, okay, which are freely standing tri-layer films, okay? And evidently he was listening to what I was telling him and performed these computer simulations looking at both the initial stages of the pattern formation in these films with and without an in-plane tension, and also expanding his calculation to allow him to go past the initial instability to the point where the layers actually come together. So he's done a lot of nice work on that. What I want to show you now is not the formation of this pattern, but what happens in this all-polymer trilayer film as I heat it up. Okay, so what I have here is once again a series of optical micrographs of one of these trilayer films, which is uniform in color at the low temperature. And I'm heating this relatively fast. And you see that at some temperature, this pattern starts to form, okay, with this fairly well-defined periodicity. But as I continue to heat, the pattern goes away and the film smooths again. And in fact, what I'm seeing here is the formation and growth of holes within the central layer of the film. So just to show you again, it's uniform in color to begin with at low temperature, and as I heat it up, this pattern starts to form. It's picked out by this interplay between van der Waals forces and elastic bending. But as I continue to heat, the capping layers, polystyrene, become liquid as well, and surface tension flattens them out. The pattern goes away, and in fact, the film pinches off the central layer, forming a hole within the central liquid layer that then grows with time. And that type of hole growth is actually qualitatively different from that for a single freely standing polymer film. So here, just to remind you, hole growth in a single film has uniform thickening of the films in the absence of a rim at the edge of the hole. Whereas for the freely standing trilayer films, we have holes that form and grow in the central layer and an accumulation of material at the edge of the hole. Just to confirm that there is an accumulation of material at the edge of the hole, we can do the optical microscopy measurement, but we can also do AFM. And we find for this line scan in the AFM image that the height of the rim here corresponding to the material at the edge of the hole is completely consistent with the amount of material that's removed from the central portion of the hole. So that the two in the central portion of the hole, what's happened is that the two capping layers have come completely together and squished out all of the central layer material to form a rim around the edge of the hole. So you can, you know, play with this system, and you can vary, well, you can vary the film thicknesses because it's a very straightforward thing to do. You can fix the capping layer thickness and vary the central layer thickness, or you can fix the central layer thickness and vary the capping layer thickness and measure the growth of holes in these films at elevated temperatures. And in all cases, we find evidence for exponential hole growth, so a plot of the logarithm of the radius versus time. Linear time gives us a straight line, and we can, from these curves, extract characteristic growth times and try to understand this rather delicate interplay between the effects of the capping layers and the effect of the central layer. And we're just in the process of sorting this out now. Basically, this is meant to be maybe a bit of motivation for somebody like Rashmi to start thinking about problems like this, and to see if they can be understood in greater detail. But basically, the relevant factors that determine the hole growth in the central layer are the surface and interfacial tensions of the two polymers, the bending energy of the capping layer material, and the dispersion interaction, or van der Waals interaction, which acts across the thickness of the film. So in the central layer, what we've done is we've eliminated the interface between the two polymers. We have no substantial bending in the central layer, and the dispersion interaction is very favorable because the layers are very close together. Whereas in the rim, we have increased the size of the interfacial area between the two polymers. We've bent the capping layer of the polystyrene, and we have increased the local thickness of the film, so the dispersion interaction is decreased. And so using all of these factors together, one can perhaps hope to understand the slowing of the hole growth with increases in both film thicknesses. I should just mention that if you were to be able to make a single film of polyisoprene, it would not survive long enough for you to measure it. Right? It is very much a liquid, and it would pop just like a soap film would. So it's not possible to do that control experiment. So really, it's hole growth within that polyisoprene layer is being determined to a large extent by the properties of the capping layer that you put on it. So it's kind of an intriguing way, I think, to measure some properties of complex flow in these multi-layered films, and provides maybe a unique window on instabilities that occur at buried interfaces. So we're not looking at an instability on the top of the film. We're looking at instabilities of buried interfaces, which are in general a little bit trickier to see. So with that, let me just reiterate that I've told you a few things about the growth of holes in polymer films. I mean, what could be a simpler experiment? Well, it turns out that the interpretation of these experiments is really quite complicated. In the case of single freely standing polystyrene films, we see evidence for a nonlinear viscoelastic phenomenon called shear thinning, as well as perhaps evidence for convective constraint release due to the large amount of shearing of the chains at the edge of the hole. For the case of the freely standing trilayer films, we see a hole growth behavior that's qualitatively different from that for single films, with the hole growth in the polyisoprene determined to a large extent by the properties of the capping layers. So with that, I will finish.
Thank you. Now you understand how clearly he explains clever and simple experiments. I use the word simple very cautiously.
Well, really, I mean, we have all of this really fancy equipment. What I've told you about today uses, you know, an optical microscope and a home-built differential pressure experiment. You know, that's about it. And so you can do, I think one of the messages is that you can do a lot of good science with simple experiments. Yeah.
Questions?
Okay, so the basic idea is there is you're shearing the polymer at such a large rate that the entanglements between the molecules are being swept away at the shear strain rate. And so they may want to sort of jiggle back and forth inside their reptation tubes, but they haven't got a chance because things are happening so quickly.
Yeah.
So it's really an add-on to the theory of reptation to account for this high shear strain rate regime. Okay. Pardon me? Sorry, you say that again? Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, but it's it's a subtlety though, and it's a good point actually. The viscosity that enters into that model is actually the shear thinned value of the viscosity. Okay?
Yeah, that one maybe don't have a constant relaxation time.
Because it's given by, or you don't have a constant modulus corresponding to that.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. You think it's a time-dependent spring? We can talk about this later, actually. I'll show you. I have a couple of backup view graphs, but it's a bit complicated. But I'll show you the analysis of the three-component spring and dashpot model.
Yes. Often standard elasticity models are generalized to make moduli frequency dependent. And maybe the spring becomes, there is some additional frequency dependence, but that's it.
The modulus value you get out of that, by the way, is about a megapascal, which is comparable to the shear stress modulus, a plateau value in a conventional kind of polymer extension experiment. Yeah.
Is there a relationship between the diameter of the holes and the transition between the linear change?
This was our first thought, right, is to check that. And there's not a good correlation there. It turns out that, it's not so much a critical radius value at which that transition takes place, but rather it will depend on how entangled the molecules are to begin with, their original or their molecular weight, the temperature at which you're doing the experiment. Those seem to be have more correlation with this transition. But that was our original thought. Hey, maybe there is some critical radius value that corresponds to this, and there doesn't seem to be very good evidence for that. It's a good idea, though.
John, in those trilayer systems we're looking at flow rate or heating, why is the pattern important? I understand why you get a tubular structure
yes.
forming, but it looks so regular. What's the relationship between film thickness and the regularity that's in that pattern.
Okay, so what you can do, I don't know if...
Characteristic length, I guess.
Yeah. Let me just see if I can find something here quickly.
I would have thought you would have a distribution and it would have been much more random.
No, there's a specific... I've got a ton of backup slides here. Let me see if I can find the right one. I'm sure I don't have the right one, though. That's right. I don't seem to. But basically, what you can do is you can write down the change in the energy of the film, okay, due to... it's basically a stability type of analysis. So you say, you assume that there is some change in the thickness of the film, right? And you look at the corresponding change in the van der Waals or dispersion force and the elastic bending energy of... And each of those has a different characteristic dependence on the thickness of the films, okay?
So that's the trick.
They are very uniform. I mean, these are spin-coated films.
Wait, and I know that you had some RMS fluctuations. When you ask one of the quick questions, things, when that, in the polystyrene, when you get the hole, there's no rim formation as you stated, right? That means the time scale for the growth is slower than the redistribution of the mass growth in the entire film. So what happens if you were to break that, if you were to form a hole, like put a laser puncture,
Well, one thing you can't, we haven't tried that experiment, but one thing we have done is literally poke a hole in the film with it's a heated STM tip, so some very sharp point. And what you get, obviously, is something quite irregular by doing a process like that, but all of the irregularities seem to smooth out on a relatively fast time scale so that, you know, shortly after the poking of the film, there doesn't seem to be any, you know, funny business going on at the edge of the hole.
For cell lysis, for example,
mm-hmm.
this is what I was saying.
Yes.
So you could poke and not disturb the membrane.
Okay. Possibly, yeah. I mean, you're talking...
That's a huge problem for people to poke.
Hmm. That's worth thinking about some more, actually.
The stuff that you've done, are there applications or are there situations in biological systems? You just did tri-layer or single-layer films, polymer films.
Yes. You could have similar instabilities in biological layers. Yeah. And in fact, you could maybe use these as templates for the growth of cells on surfaces. I mean, any time you have a nice way of controlling the periodicity in a well-defined fashion for a surface, you can investigate the effect of that periodicity on things like the adhesion of biological molecules and so on. Here we're in a relatively long wavelength regime. This is only unstable for relatively large wavelengths of several micrometers. So even bacterial cells are in general smaller than that. But maybe if you look at red blood cells or something like that, you could see some interesting effects.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker for...